I think everyone is old timers. Everyone are old timers. Welcome. I want to talk about the wisdom of the middle way. Of course, the middle way is our religion. But it also describes a path, an attitude, just a few synonyms or reflections on the term middle way. It brings up the idea of moderation or compromise, settled, being settled, synthesis, being balanced. So the Buddha had a few practices and environments in his life. He started off in his first few decades in his father's palace, surrounded with opulence. He then became a wandering monk and practiced austerities, two poles of existence. And when he was down to eating those, you know, that one little sesame seed a day to deny the body and to try to have an understanding of the world, he just said, you know, this isn't it. And he had a little bit of rustling of the heart and spirit when he was offered that rice porridge, you know, finally getting something in his stomach, being a little more comfortable, and then making his way to the under the Bodhi tree in that meditation, where he had his realization. So he tells us a little bit about that, about the middle way, in one of our sutras that we chant. Monks, these two extremes ought not to be practiced by one who has gone forth from the worldly life. What are the two? There is devotion to pursuing sense pleasures, which is degrading, common, the way of ordinary people, unworthy and unprofitable. And there is devotion to self-mortification, which is painful, unworthy, and unprofitable. So he told his comrades about these two poles to avoid in practice, chasing after sense pleasures on one hand and self-mortification on the other hand. Avoiding both these extremes, the Tathagata has realized the middle way. It gives vision, it gives knowledge, leads to peace, to insight, to awakening, and to freedom. So this middle way, this moderation, taking on the attitude of moderation, leads to awakening and freedom. And then he goes on to say, and what is this middle way? It is simply the Noble Eightfold Path, namely right view, right thought, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. So he says this attitude of moderation. He asks us to watch our thoughts, watch our speech, watch our behavior, settle down and be reflective. That's the middle way that Buddha taught us. I brought a lot of books, but I'm just doing one-liners. He repeats himself a little bit in another sutra, the exposition of non-conflict. So that fits with the middle way. You know, it's about non-conflict. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both extremes. And these are, one should not pursue sensual pleasure, which is low, vulgar, coarse, ignoble, and unbeneficial. And one should not pursue self-mortification, which is painful, ignoble, and unbeneficial. The middle way discovered by the Tathagata avoids both these extremes, gives vision, gives knowledge. It leads to peace, to direct knowledge, to enlightenment and nirvana. So this middle way, this posture of moderation and practicing, watching our thoughts and our words and our behavior, leads to enlightenment and to nirvana. It makes sense. You know, also, I like to think it's the sutra of Goldilocks, not too hot, not too cold, just right. The middle way is about balance, and Dogen instructs us to lean left, lean right. Find a comfortable place on our zafus, balanced in this cross-legged posture that reflects symmetry. We're taught in many sutras about abiding. To abide in our Dharma position. Abiding has that sentiment of comfort and settling in completely. A group of us are working with Neti in a koan study. We're going through koans, and we live with the koans for a week. We study them. We bring them into our lives. And we come to the class on Friday afternoons at 1 o'clock with our ideas about what these koans might mean. And you've all looked at a few koans. They're kind of cryptic. They're spare in language. They can be interpreted in many ways. So we come with, you know, this is how it's. This is what it's meaning for me in this week's study and living with this koan. We've got an idea that we're sharing. But in that environment of the class, and many of our classes here at Zen Center are like that, that kind of discussion where we're openly accepting what other people are saying, we're taking that in, synthesizing what other people say about the koan, and it might be something completely different. They may have looked at another part of the koan that was meaningful and, that seems sort of closed and dark to my reading. So someone might have another idea about the koan. And then when we study it again the next week, we use all of that information that we've shared to see how it's going to live with us in our bodies the next week. And we might do that a time or two. So there's that idea of synthesizing from our environment, from our Dharma friends, in a way that we can study these koans, in a way these koans can start abiding in our bodies. They can settle into our lives, and we can settle more into the stories of the koans. Of course, the koans are usually set up to pull us one way or another. I mean, they're set up to defend, so that we might defend one opinion or another. And usually the resolution or the way the koan ultimately lives with us is some resolution to that polarity or duality. The one that we're studying this week is Nan Chuan Kills the Cat, where it starts out, the monks on the west side and the monks on the east side, the monks on the east side and the monks on the west side are fighting over the cat. And Nan Chuan holds up the cat and says, "Say something and I'll save the cat." So immediately, I imagine the monks are saying, "I've got this idea about the cat," and the monks on the other side are saying, "I've got this idea about the cat." Nan Chuan just says, "Say something." Nan Chuan just says, "Say anything." Even though there's these two strong ideas about the cat, just say anything. And everybody's kind of frozen with not knowing what to do. You know, we don't know why they're frozen. You know, maybe they're really holding on tightly to their ideas, to their side of the cat story. Or maybe they're afraid of saying, maybe they think if they say the wrong thing, the cat's doomed. If they say nothing, the cat's doomed. If they say the wrong thing, the cat's doomed. But they're frozen. And the koan says that the cat is doomed. And then Nan Chuan, talks about this event to another monk and says, "This is what happened. Say something." I asked them to say something and save the cat, and nobody said anything. And the other monk he talked with took off his sandals and put them on his head and walked out of the room. And Nan Chuan says, "If you would have been there, that cat would have been saved." So what comes out of this duality is something completely different. Something that maybe wasn't in the room before, that maybe that opinion, whatever that opinion expresses, wasn't in the room before. But almost anything could have started this discussion on on what do we do about this? How do we find this middle road between the two opinions about the cat? And, you know, putting the sandals on the head is a good start. You know, where do we go from here? That's all that Nan Chuan wanted to elicit. Let's get this thing started. Let's get this thing settled. Let's find a compromise. Let's find a middle way. It makes me think, though, too, of that term compromise usually means, you know, letting go of a little bit of this and accepting a little bit of that, so that everything in the room still stays in the room, just weighed a little differently. You know, that's sort of what compromise is for me. I give up a little bit, but I take on a little bit of that other opinion. I'm open to that other opinion, and maybe a little bit less of this and a little bit more of this is something we can all live with. But you know, we've got other koans and other ways to think about this. The one about sitting in meditation and thinking, not thinking. Thinking, not thinking. And the monk appropriately says, "What's that?" Thinking, not thinking. And the response is, beyond thinking. So our practice of the middle way sometimes asks us to go beyond compromise. And maybe that's what the monk in the cat story was doing by putting the sandals on his head. Maybe that wasn't one of the choices in the room. Maybe that was beyond thinking. And at the very least, it was getting the show on the road. It was getting the show on the back to the middle way, away from these polarities of this and that. Our own Reverend Kathy Toldy has talked to us about discussions that we have in our board of trustees, our board of directors that we have here at Zen Center, how to work through the conversations and negotiations and decisions that we've made over the years to keep Zen Center going. And she's talked to us about that groan zone where, you know, the East Side monks have an idea about the Dokusan room, and the West Side monks have another idea. And how do we actually come up with the Dokusan room? So the leader of this discussion, which right now is Edie, has to work with the monks on the two sides of the room through this groan zone where people are saying, "Well, you know, I want it to look like this," and another monk might say, "That's going to be too much money. We've got to make it look like this. We can't spend more than this amount of money." And everybody's putting their 2 cents in, and we're writing all of that down. And you know, it goes on for a long time, not just one meeting. A lot of our discussions in Zen Center go on for years. But you know, certainly planning a Dokusan room has taken a long time. And so there's that groan zone that's maybe about compromise, but it's definitely about, we're writing it all down. It's all on the board. It's all in the room. And with that contribution of all the thoughts of all the monks, and everybody has made a commitment that we're going to get through this and that we're going to get a Dokusan room, or we're going to remodel the Zendo, or we're going to, how many bathrooms should we build over in the other house? Those were all old discussions. We've all made a commitment that, we're going to have this finished product at the end. So this grown zone is going to go on until we can come up with a good idea. And sometimes it's about compromise, and sometimes it's about going beyond. Sometimes a completely different, after a few discussions, a completely different idea is going to come into that room. Maybe based on the discussions we've had before, ideas we've had before, hearing ideas for the first time and living with them till the next board meeting, and something new comes up. Maybe something that goes beyond. But we all come out the other side. We all get through that grown zone to come up with a Zen center, to come up with daily practice. I think about what goes on in psychotherapy. I've been in a lot of psychotherapy. And on one level, we might think of that as how does my past determine my reality right now? And I tell stories over and over in therapy about events in the past and why they're popping up now. And it's helpful. It's helpful to talk about that. It's helpful to get some feedback from another person. Maybe change my ideas a little bit about the impact of certain events in my life. So that's helpful. But psychotherapy also has this going beyond feature too. It's at some point, even in the midst of talking about my mother, the therapist might point out something about my relationship right with the therapist. They might look right at that. Even though I'm sitting there mulling over this event with my mother, the therapist might say, "Well, what do you think about me right now?" I mean, not those terms, but this is about being right here in the room with me. So this, what's going on, in this relationship that reminded you of that story? So I think that whole idea, and I know there's therapists in the room, and I know there's other people in this room that have been in therapy. Really looking at that transference is, I think, the going beyond part of psychotherapy that really is neat when it's used effectively at the right time and takes a lot of history. You have to hear a lot about the mother And then at just the right time, you can talk about the relationship right here in the room. And of course, the therapist is also looking at her opinions towards me. You know, what while I'm going on about my mother, you know, oh, not that story again. I've heard that story a lot. And the skilled therapist can kind of use that idea too of, you know, I wonder what's really happening right here. So the therapy, you know, might be thought of the two poles as, you know, my life right now versus my life in the past. The therapy might be the two poles. I'm sitting here and the therapist sitting there, and we're talking together, giving each other feedback on what I've been saying. And the going beyond part is, you know, looking at that transference and counter-transference, that relationship, that energy that's going on right in the room, is that beyond space right in the middle, you know, neither this nor that. And when we can both pay attention to that, sometimes magic happens. We've gone beyond this and that, me and you. This is what I wrote about the thinking, not thinking, beyond thinking. I just want to read it and see if I need to say more about it. Our practice of realizing our harmonious unity as the universe lies in a very different way of holding our thoughts. Not thinking, thinking. We have to hold our thoughts in a little different way. We have to realize our harmonious unity with the universe. We don't try to stop thinking. We let thoughts go. We loosen our grip on our ideas and open to our experience. The Four Foundations of Mindfulness was Buddha's lesson on meditation and awareness. Thank you, Richard. This sounds a little familiar. He says that this practice is the direct path for the purification of beings, for surmounting of sorrow and lamentation, for the disappearance of suffering and discontent, for acquiring the true method, for the realization of nirvana. That sounds a lot like his lecture on the middle way that I started off with. That this middle way, this path of the middle way, opens us up for liberation and enlightenment and nirvana. And he says it again about meditation. It's the direct path for purification of beings, for the realization of nirvana. And now, monks, need more glasses. And how, monks, does the monk in regard to the body abide contemplating the body? He goes to the forest, the root of a tree, or sits in an empty hut. He sits down, he folds his legs crosswise, sits up straight. Mindful, he breathes in, mindful, he breathes out. Breathing in long, he knows, I breathe in long. Breathing out long, he knows, I breathe out long. Breathing in short, he knows, I breathe in short. Breathing out short, he knows, I breathe out short. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, experiencing the whole body. I shall breathe out, experiencing the whole body. He trains thus. I shall breathe in, calming the bodily formations. He trains thus. I shall breathe out, calming the bodily formations. So this is in regard to the body, and this is a practice for the direct purification of beings, for the realization of nirvana. Paying attention to our breath, experiencing the body, calming the body. So our practice, our realization isn't any out-of-body experience. It's not something rare. It's pretty close at hand. It's right here in this body and breath. I think that's another association with the middle way. It's pretty comfortable. It's pretty near at hand. It's not on the periphery of experience. It's right here in the body. I've been looking at the fundamentals of the middle way, Nagarjuna's understanding of the middle way. And it's written in a poem form, poetic form. So pretty spare, just like the koans. Poetic language, a lot of the time, pretty cryptic, pretty obtuse. Is that a good word to describe that? Can be interpreted many ways. And it's like going to Nettie's class. And I've got four translations and four commentaries on Nagarjuna's middle way. One of them is pretty philosophical. It's hard to understand the translation, and it's hard to understand the philosophical underpinnings in the commentary that the author comes up with. But it can be a good reference book when I'm stuck in other places. Another one, the translation is pretty similar, pretty hard to understand the translation, the commentary I'm able to get into a little bit more. And so those first two are pretty good reference books for me, seeing the two ways of looking at it. There's another one by Stephen Batchelor, Verses from the Center. And he, of course, is quite a Buddhist scholar, but a great writer. He said, you know, I'm going to make my own poetry. So he is trying to teach kind of the difficult verses of Nagarjuna, but with his own poetry. So it's not quite a direct translation. It's his own unique translation, but it's poetry. And in modern language, and it's also a good resource. Just last night I was looking at that one, and it really opened up this this kind of difficult passage for me in the first two books. And I've recently gotten a fourth one, a translation by Nishijima. You know, who we look at Nishijima as a pretty definitive translation of Dogen. Gudo Nishijima just died in his 90s, a year or so ago. And he taught lots of Western students. And one of his Western students helped him do the commentary. So, Nishijima said, "I want to be as close as I possibly can to what I think is the best translation for me of Nagarjuna," and his is a little different than all three of the others. And he and his Western student have really come up with a unique position, some unique ideas. So it's like our class, you know. We've got all these ideas in the room that are pretty good. And when I go to study Nagarjuna, I bring all those, and then I take what they say into my life. You know, how is Nagarjuna and his teachings of emptiness going to help me in my practice, help me with liberation and enlightenment, nirvana? Nagarjuna, of course, teaches about he's the great teacher of emptiness. And this is me talking. This is not any of the other four. You know, maybe the two poles that Nagarjuna wanted to avoid, the two sides, was, you know, something having an intrinsic nature on one side, a soul, something true throughout time and space. You know, that's the spirit of Jeffrey that will never pass. That intrinsic self, or the spirit of this book, or the spirit of this table, or the spirit of that oak tree. That intrinsic self-nature on one side. He said, avoid that, in the same way that Buddha said, perhaps, you know, avoid sensual pleasures. The other side is that something pops up out of nothing, that nothing causes anything; it just appears. He said, don't go there. And maybe for Nagarjuna, the middle way is that dependent co-arising, that constellation, that myriad constellation of causes and conditions that come together in this moment and create this book, or this being, or that candle flame, and depends on a whole different constellation of causes and conditions the next moment. Maybe that's his position on the middle way and emptiness. But Nagarjuna and Nishijima and Brad Warner, his Nishijima's student, looked at it this way, looked at our practice this way. The real universe can be thought of as a fusion between the real and the unreal. Another way of saying this can be found in the Heart Sutra, which says, form is emptiness and emptiness is form. Reality is a fusion of mind and matter. Mind and matter are, in the final analysis, the very same thing. Matter seems to be stable and real, while the mind seems to be unstable and unreal. Yet these two are manifestations of one real thing. I thought that was a pretty good idea. That something as solid as this lectern, to even call it a lectern, we need my mind to say, to have this, to name it, and to think about it, and have a history of it. So this unreal, unstable cause comes together with something hard in this particular shape, and only then does the lectern appear. I thought that was a pretty good idea of form and emptiness. Something to think about. The reason that the real universe does not seem to manifest clearly comes from the unbalanced situation of our autonomic nervous system. Science tells us that the human autonomic nervous system consists of two parts. These are the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nervous systems. These two nervous systems, scientists say, work in opposition to one another. It is my belief that the workings of the sympathetic nervous system are the true basis of philosophy we call materialism, while the workings of the parasympathetic nervous system are the fundamental basis of the philosophy we call idealism or spirituality. So do we remember those from science class? You know, when we see that tiger in the woods, our sympathetic nervous system kicks in and we need to run like crazy. So we get our fast heartbeat and our fast breathing and our blood flows openly to our legs and closes down in our arms, you know, so we can get out of there. Our pupils get very big. He says the sympathetic nervous system is about meeting the world. That's what he says about that. That's why he mentioned it's the fundamental basis of that philosophy called materialism, meeting the world. Where the parasympathetic nervous system is more internal, it's more about digestion. Gabriel has heard me talk about this. It's more about sphincters and releasing our bowels and urinating. It's more about digestion. Not that that goes on a lot in the meditation hall here, but meditation is said to promote that parasympathetic nervous system, to slow down our breathing, to slow down our heart rate. Not make us so reactive. You know, when we're scared by that tiger in the woods, even when we're finally at a safe place, for a while we're pretty jumpy. You know, now our world is a dangerous one. So we're pretty jumpy. That sympathetic nervous system lingers on. Whereas, you know, if we could finally get into the zendo after running from that tiger, you know, our breath would slow down. Our heart rate would slow down. We would feel balanced, a little more spiritual. We might see the bigger picture. Oh, the tiger was hungry. It's just the what's the term? Zenki.
Undivided activity?
Total dynamic
functioning. You know, tigers are hungry and they need food. Something beautiful was just happening out there in the forest. So here's this, you know, Nishijima wrote this in his 80s. He was looking at our practice. He was, you know, our practice of realizing harmony as the universe. This sitting practice that was described to us as following the breath, as calming the body, as calming the paying attention to the body and calming the bodily functions. Buddha said that. Nishijima says that that when I read Nagarjuna, I think of our balancing our nervous system, so that we're not too reactive to craving, to things we want. And here's a Buddha again saying, you know, don't abide too deeply in sense pleasures. Nishijima says, calm down your sympathetic nervous system, so you're not so reactive to the phenomenal world. He said, don't get too deep into your parasympathetic symptoms. I'll read the rest. When the parasympathetic nervous system is strong, we feel spiritual. Our mind becomes clearer, but we lose contact with our body. So we don't want to get too deep into meditation, that we're not paying attention to our body, that we're not paying attention to our Dharma family, taking care of our Dharma family. So Nishijima says this meditation is about our autonomic nervous system, and through our autonomic nervous system is where we understand the real universe. So time is up here, but I thought that whole idea has really followed us from Buddha to Nishijima, about balance in the middle of the middle way. Synthesis and going beyond as a way of the direct path leading towards nirvana, as Buddha says. I think that's the path for me, that the middle way. And my body can tell me when I'm a little out there on a limb. And paying attention to that body can bring me back to the breath and calming the bodily functions and aware of the real world, as Nishijima says. So if someone would like one last comment on the middle way or their practice with the body, we've got time for one question.
Okay.
Gabriel.
In terms of the dichotomy of sitting, noticing your body, you know, being close to your body, almost attached to it while meditating, and then there's the other side, which is letting go of the body and the mind. So could you kind of explain the difference there, some sort?
The next paragraph in Nishijima says that this balancing the autonomic nervous system is what Dogen calls dropping body and mind. But that's how we sit in zazen. I mean, are you talking about, you know, sometimes you're following the breath, and the wall in front of you is this pleasant, hazy color. You're not paying so much attention to the patterns of the stucco. Sometimes you're really right there in the body, and then maybe a couple minutes later, that knee starts barking.
Yeah, so it's kind of intertwined.
And more than intertwined, it's the whole works. Both Nishijima, Nagarjuna, and all three of them, and the Buddha, are all saying, you know, this is our practice. You acknowledge being in this body with this knee hurting right now. And you might tell yourself a few things. You know, I've been in a few sesshins. I know my leg hurts. I know it's not going to be dangerous. I might have to relax my quadriceps a little bit. I might have to relax my lower back a little bit. And I know that this is my practice, following the body, paying attention to the body. And you do those exercises. You do that relaxation. And then you just swing right back into your breath. And, you know, your next concrete thought might be, oh, that's the bell. And you've gotten through another period of meditation as you know, from the last 40 minutes that, you know, you were in harmony with the universe. So that's it might seem like you're swinging from one pole to the other, but that's actually the whole practice, staying in the body, taking care of the body as if you were taking care of Carl, our Dharma friend, who's helping through his surgery. So you're not swinging anywhere. You're right there in the body, and that's our practice. Thank you. Thank you. Beings are numberless.